From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and let's get right to Tropical Storm Harvey, which is causing catastrophic flooding in East Texas, including in Houston and Galveston. In some counties, there's already been up to 30 inches of rain. Joining us now is Louis Uccellini, the director of the National Weather Service. Dr. Uccellini, welcome.
Glad to be here.
And what are your main concerns at this point with Harvey?
Well, Harvey, as predicted, is turning out to be an extreme rainfall producer and a prolonged event. And this morning we saw very heavy rainfall move into eastern Texas, western Louisiana. And there was a slight pause over Houston, but that rain is now redeveloping right over the Houston metropolitan area and has the potential of producing another 15 inches of rain over the next couple of days. So very, very concerned about that whole area. And I should also note that the circulation of the storm has drifted back towards the southeast and is actually located right on the coast. So it has a great opportunity to develop slightly, but more importantly, sustain the circulation, which will bring that moisture-laden air over Texas and southwest and western Louisiana.
What's your forecast at this point about where the storm exactly is going to go?
Well, the National Hurricane Center is forecasting a track that drifts slightly southeast from its current location. And then by Wednesday morning, it'll be located right off the Galveston Bay. And then by Thursday morning, move up into eastern Texas and weaken into a depression. You can see from that, we're dealing with a very slow-moving storm system, which is adding to the potential for devastating impacts in that area.
And just remind us why it's so slow-moving, why it has kind of stalled out over Texas.
Well, as is the case in the summer, the upper-level flow regime is relatively weak in the southern half of the country, especially over the Gulf of Mexico. If you do have a steering current, as we call it, these storms can move along at about 15, 20 miles an hour as they make landfall and then move on up towards the north-northeast. In this case, very weak flow, and in a very real sense, the storm is creating its own circulation system all the way up through the atmosphere in its own steering current. So it's circling around and right now drifting towards the southeast.
The National Weather Service tweeted yesterday that, quote, this event is unprecedented and all impacts are unknown and beyond anything experienced. Tell us what was so unprecedented about this storm.
We, of course, are seeing extreme rainfall rates with the bands that are circulating up into Texas and now western Louisiana. But it's the prolonged nature of the bands. They last for hours. They train individual cells right over the same areas, giving very extreme rainfall rates over a short period of time. For example, Houston had close to 2 feet of rain overnight, Friday night into Saturday morning. And then the whole slow movement of the storm not only keeps that kind of precipitation potential alive, but it covers a large area. So we're seeing now a large area of 2 feet or above, you know, from south central Texas all the way up towards Houston. Eastern Texas is getting in the act, western Louisiana. So we got this very large area of extreme rainfall rates and total rainfall expected with this event. As we've said in our forecast, you can get individual locations getting up to 50 inches of rain when all is said and done. So that's the reason. The impact is beyond catastrophic, as some of our partners have indicated that are on the ground. And it's just the aerial extent. And let's not forget, when this storm made landfall, it made landfall as a Category 4, the first one since 1961 in the state of Texas, with a very large surge, 6 to 12 feet, over a large area extending northeast from where it made landfall. So we're still assessing the damage associated with that from Friday night. So all in all, it's really an incredible event.
We remember back to Hurricane Katrina, though, and after the initial hit, some people thought that they were out of the woods, and then we learned days later that that was not the case at all. Are you worried about that at all in this case?
Well, this is why we're emphasizing, in fact, our partners in FEMA, in the state of Texas, the local emergency management community is cautioning that they haven't even gotten into some of these areas yet. So the assessment is ongoing, the life-saving activities are ongoing, and it's going to take days, if not weeks, to make a full assessment of the impact. With Katrina, the nature of the surge wasn't recognized early on, and then, of course, when the levees gave, it just exacerbated the damage. So, you know, we're dealing with a very extreme event from a water perspective, whether it was the surge on Friday night or the continuing rainfall that can go on now. We're looking at heavy rains affecting this area right towards the end of the week. So this system is not over by a large stretch, and therefore the tweet that we sent out yesterday.
That's Louis Uccellini, who is the director of the National Weather Service. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Let's turn just for a moment to some other news. Expedia CEO Dara Khosrowshahi has a new job at Uber. He'll replace Travis Kalanick as the ride-hailing service's top executive, and he'll try to turn the company around. And this announcement comes after recent moves by Uber to take what it admits are overdue steps to keep its drivers satisfied, including boosting pay and providing more support for the 600,000 or so Uber drivers on the nation's roads during a typical week. But as Martin DeCaro from WAMU in Washington reports, the company that's kept customers happy with cheap rides is still figuring out how to do the same for drivers.
Kim Hall drives for a living behind the wheel of a school bus in Maryland. It's a long day.
My job actually is a split shift, so I get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and my evening shift wouldn't end till 6.
You can imagine how tired she must have been after she started driving for Uber, too, to make a little more money.
It was consuming my life at one point.
But despite all the hours on the road, Hall says it wasn't profitable. The fares were often very low.
Net to you would be like $4.
And she leased a car from Uber. The weekly payment, $137. That's a lot of fares just to break even.
Like Friday night and a Saturday, I would maybe earn like $180-some. And once Uber takes their $130-something, you know, I'm left with $50. And that's just not worth my time.
So after a year of juggling the two jobs, Hall quit Uber. The money simply was not what she expected. And enough drivers seemingly agree because the company is making some changes. Up first, the launch of in-app tipping.
The number one request of drivers.
And Uber DC spokesman Bill Gibbons says drivers will also get 24/7 phone support, protection from unjustified bad ratings, $15 every time they return a lost item to a passenger, and faster document review when they apply for the job.
This is a start, and I want to emphasize this is a start. 180 days of change that we've committed to.
But one thing Uber won't commit to is raising drivers' rates. Uber keeps rates low to compete with Lyft and other ride-hailing apps. That's its business model. Instead, it boosts drivers' earnings with incentives and bonuses. But researcher Katie Wells at George Washington University says this makes it next to impossible for drivers to figure out how much they might make.
They had a feeling that they were making money, but when we actually did the math with them, some of them came down to hourly earnings that were below minimum wage.
Wells is studying whether Uber's promises of freedom and flexibility amount to good income. Her research team interviewed 40 drivers in the Washington, D.C. area. She says the only way to make any real money is to stay on the road for hours on end, waiting for surge pricing to kick in, or accept enough rides that you qualify for bonuses the following week.
For some of them, there was adrenaline involved. Like, they were going to beat the system.
But all the while, expenses are mounting.
Gas, insurance, maintenance of the vehicle.
She says this is important because Uber is one of the Washington region's largest employers, with 30,000 drivers on the streets. Uber's Bill Gibbons says the recent batch of improvements proves the company is listening to them.
We want them to give us a chance. We're hoping we're making this experience as seamless and convenient and stress-free as possible for them. We want this to be a good way for them to make extra income.
Despite what critics say, Uber has hundreds of thousands of drivers on its platforms and remains the dominant ride-sharing company.
There's definitely some positives. People enjoy the flexibility.
Harry Campbell is the rideshare guy. At least that's the name of his blog, a veritable encyclopedia for drivers of the gig economy.
But at the same time, I think that over the years, Uber has really prioritized passengers, and drivers haven't necessarily benefited from a lot of Uber's growth.
Campbell says Uber is now starting to repair its relationship with drivers, but he says don't expect Uber to simply raise rates. And he has a theory why they'll remain so low, to convince casual customers to dump their cars and rely solely on a combination of Uber and public transportation.
They get riders going from casual users to sort of those raving fans who need Uber for 10, 20, 30 rides a week.
Uber limo driver Henok Wadra says he's been on the platform 4.5 years, but his weekly earnings are more unpredictable now than they were when he started. Now he's competing against so many more drivers for lower fares.
Between 400 to 1,000, 1,200.
But he intends to stick with it.
Sometimes it's what you do best. You know, this is, you know, the profession he chose.
6 years after Uber arrived in D.C. and other cities, it's still a challenge to keep riders and drivers happy. For Here and Now, I'm Martin DeCaro.
Along with historic flooding, Harvey is also expected to cause significant beach erosion along the entire Texas coastline. And 65% of that coastline may experience a severe level of erosion called dune overwash, as waves and storm surge cause major changes to the landscape. Beach erosion is a problem faced by all coastal communities that are seeing more frequent flooding, more severe storms, and rising sea levels. David Boeri from member station WBUR reports now from one vulnerable spot, North Carolina's Outer Banks.
Water is the driving force of all nature, wrote Leonardo da Vinci. Da Vinci, who was fascinated by great storms and terrible floods, would have loved the Outer Banks of North Carolina. Nearly 200 miles of low-lying, shifting sand islands link into a high-energy system of waves and storms.
These beaches are doomed. The buildings are doomed, too.
Professor Orrin Pilkey of Duke University is an octogenarian prophet in vacation land. Traveling through a shanty town of McMansions on stilts, motels and condos too close to the sea, Pilkey stops in the town of Nag's Head. He predicts the kind of catastrophe that would have drawn Da Vinci.
The future is one of retreat. That's the only way to save the beach, the only way to save the buildings.
The island wants to move. It wants to migrate west. And normally that happens when waves and wind carry sand over the dunes to the backside in the quiet waters. Trouble begins, though, when people build big houses and big motels close to the beach, like this Comfort Inn, where we're staying.
The Comfort Inn is a symbol of the problem. There is a 6-story building that's right next to the beach.
Pilkey actually missed counting the ground floor, which makes 7 stories. Either way, it's too big to move. Past storms swallowed both its pool and its deck. The shoreline in the Outer Banks has lost 1,500 feet, in some places 3,000 feet in the last century and a half. Hurricanes and winter storms routinely swallow homes. As for the Comfort Inn,
it's a future disaster. You know, the time will come when that will be a good offshore fishing reef.
The old-timers used to live on the backside of the barrier islands. Coastal geologist Stan Riggs of East Carolina University, who spent half a century studying the dynamics of the Outer Banks, says old-timers knew that building on the ocean side is like building on railroad tracks. To protect themselves from that train, current owners and investors place their hope in engineering. But it's the storms that bring sand in the first place.
You can engineer this system, but at some point you don't have a barrier island, and you surely won't have a beach unless you pump sand.
Down the chain of islands at Buxton Beach, they're doing just that. Bulldozers are moving sand that's spewing out of a pipe. Riggs points offshore to a dredge ship 2 miles away that's piping it in.
It comes from that dredge across the bottom. That's what he's sucking out of the bottom out there.
It's called beach nourishment, as if it's therapeutic. But it's a high-cost prescription to replace the sand that's gone from the natural beach. This project costs over $7 million a mile, $22 million in all public money. The engineers guarantee a life of 5 years, but Riggs says the sand, the nourishment, is generally gone in two.
These land masses are moving. They've always moved. They always will move. They're storm-dependent systems. They have to have storms, and you have to let them breathe or you're going to kill them.
Storms are the drivers of change. With rising sea levels, small storms will do the same damage that bigger ones do now, and hurricanes will bring waves with storm surge stacked even higher. Orrin Pilkey, the prophet, calls for repentance.
One of the best ways to respond to the sea level rise is do not allow people to rebuild their house after it's been severely damaged by a storm.
Damaged or destroyed, those mom-and-pop houses give way to massive beach houses on stilts whose owners call for more pumped sand and more engineering to protect their investment.
If your building has been severely damaged by a storm, surely you would understand that it's going to happen again.
As we drive down Highway 12, our coastal geologist, Stan Riggs, shows us where it has been buckled, broken, breached, and rolled over by storms. At Oregon Inlet, we watch the construction of a new bridge, 3 miles long, and at the cost of $250 million, a 100-year bridge that connects two islands that won't be here in 100 years, Riggs says. He warned against building it and called for a ferry system instead. So this is a bridge to nowhere.
Absolutely.
We drive to Rodanthe, where a real estate sign beckons, "Dare to dream the impossible dream." Close to the beach, where on a normal tide, the surf reaches the stilts of a high-rise home that stands alone, like a man awaiting the firing squad. Farther south, at Buxton Beach, Stan points to where 5 homes once stood, where now there is nothing but narrow beach at the base of a steep bank.
This is the first time in 2 weeks I have been able to sit on this beach because the water has been right up here, low tide and high tide, every single day.
Used to be 200 yards wide, says one of the anxious neighbors. And homeowner Freevee Pace has one big question for Stan Riggs about beach nourishment.
Well, this is a big experiment. If it works, if
you
don't
have it... Do you think it will work?
We don't know.
Nearby, you can throw a rock from one side of this island to the other. Riggs tells her if it does work, this beach nourishment will buy her a little time. The last place Riggs brings us is Seagull Drive, back in Nag's Head.
There were probably 75 houses here that have 50 of them which are in the ocean and gone.
Sandbags stacked up to their decks couldn't save them. I stand under one lone leaning derelict ready to go, its septic tank exposed on the beach like a sunbather on her towel. If sea level rises 3 feet by the end of the century, Riggs says, no amount of sand nourishment will provide even a temporary stay for the Outer Banks. By then, the beaches and the barriers will be gone, and our great-grandchildren will be worrying instead about saving their homes in the cities and suburbs. For Here and Now, I'm David Bowery.
The U.S. Open Tennis Tournament begins today in New York City. For a preview, we're joined by Tom Parada. He writes about tennis for the Wall Street Journal. Tom, it's good to have you on Here and Now.
Glad to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. So, first of all, let's just start off with the big news in the men's field, and that is the fact that on Saturday, Andy Murray, former world number one, pulled out of the U.S. Open, catching everyone by surprise because it happened so late. But there's still Roger Federer and Rafael Nadal still in it. So who's your favorite at this point?
Well, it's a really wide-open tournament because of injuries and a lot of guys have been pulled out. And Federer was a little bit hurt leading up to this tournament, too. He had a bit of a sore back, but he seems to be fine now. I would say Federer, Nadal, and also Dimitrov, who's a fantastic player. And another person to look at is a young player named Alexander Zverev. He's only 20 years old. He won a tournament this summer. He's super talented. He has phenomenal shots, and he's very confident right now.
And he's from Germany, right?
Yes, that's right.
Interesting, though, about Federer and Nadal, it's hard to not talk about them. They're in the same half of the draw, right? So we can't have a Federer-Nadal final.
can have a Federer and Nadal final. You can have a Federer and Nadal semifinal. We've never had a Federer and Nadal anything at the U.S. Open. It's the only Grand Slam tournament where they haven't played. So it would be nice to see it for once, but they've never quite had that luck.
Okay. Well, let's move on to the women now. And it's so interesting. Tennis is so dominated by these superstar names. Let's talk about the person who's not there. First of all, this is a field without Serena Williams. So will it be as exciting a tournament?
As I wrote this summer, it means I'm watching everybody because yeah. Anything in the world can happen. You really have no idea. There's players who have been playing well, but then they lose early rounds. They come into the tournament looking bad, and then they make it to the final. So it's very hard to make calls. But to me, it makes it very exciting to watch because I think there's so many good matches. First and second round matches, some of them go to full three sets and are really tough.
So this is an opportunity for perhaps people to shine who we otherwise might not have noticed. But what about Maria Sharapova? She is in the tournament as a wild card after her 15-month suspension for taking a banned substance.
I'm not sure how she's going to do this time because she's been pretty hurt. She hasn't played that much this summer, and she's playing against Simona Halep, who's the second seed and is very good. That's an amazing first-round lineup, very rare to see, and that's going to be tonight.
Okay. Now, what about the U.S. women then? There are some who show some real promise. Venus Williams, we should note, is in the tournament, but also Madison Keys. Tell us about her.
Madison Keys is a super talented player and has never made the semifinals one year in her life at the Australian Open. She's playing really well. She's had a lot of injury troubles, but right now she says she feels 100% healthy, so this could be a really good tournament for her. We've had lots of good American young women, but we've never had them, other than the Williams sisters, winning Grand Slam titles. So it would be interesting to see Keys maybe push that far.
Well, Tom Perotta writes about tennis for The Wall Street Journal. Tom, thank you so very much.
Oh, thanks for having me.
People living across the Texas coast traveled inland to avoid the worst of Hurricane Harvey when it made landfall on Friday night. Claire McInerney from member station KUT spent the weekend with evacuees in Yoakum as they waited out the storm.
When 13-year-old Grady Tomek's family chose to leave their home in Shiner, they packed the essentials to endure through a hurricane. Water, food, clothes. For Tomek, that also meant his guitar.
It's just our house is probably going to get destroyed, so, yeah.
Who are you here with?
My parents and my brother.
I met Grady under an awning at the Regency Inn in Yoakum. Starting early Saturday morning, power and Wi-Fi went out, so he picked up his guitar.
It's just, I've been bored, so I've been playing guitar.
By Saturday afternoon, that boredom spread beyond 13-year-olds without their cell phones and Snapchat. Everyone at the hotel was feeling it.
Boredom, darling, boredom. Oh my gosh.
Rachel Burns traveled to Yoakum with her 90-year-old mother from Palacios.
I've had enough. Let me out of this cage. You almost feel trapped because you can't go anywhere and you can't do anything and you can't get any information. And then when you finally get to hear a tidbit of information, it's like oxygen, you know?
The lack of information and boredom made Burns venture outside of her hotel Saturday afternoon. Despite the inches of rain that fell in Yoakum, she drove around the block and found a restaurant with the lights on. Mimi's Kitchen is a diner adjacent to another motel in Yoakum. And while the entire town was without power, their electricity was working.
I don't know why the power's still on here, but I know this is one of the highest points in town.
Kaylee Lurkey co-owns Mimi's with her mother, Mimi York. When they saw that their restaurant had power and talked to the owner of the hotel next door, they decided to open.
Once we seen he was booked with evacuees, we were thinking if they have no microwaves, they have nothing to eat hot food. Some of them may not have money to get food. So we were like, you know what, we're going to open up.
Mimi is the cook here and tried to go to the local grocery store to see if there was any food left. There wasn't, so she decided to work with what was in her fridge.
We couldn't get supplies either, so we figured we'd cook what we had. We'd rather cook it and serve it than throw it away if it rotted in the bad weather.
Which on this day meant a limited but certainly Texas-inspired menu Kaylee could offer guests.
We have chili with cornbread, stew with cornbread, and we also have tuna salad sandwiches with chips and bologna sandwiches with chips. And tea comes with everything.
The crowd in the diner was a mix of regulars coming to watch news on the TV and evacuees enjoying the hot meal. That meal helped improve Rachel Burns' mood. Sitting outside her hotel room while her elderly mother slept, she smoked a cigarette. She said thinking about the state of her home was too overwhelming right now, especially after she spoke with someone from the county next to hers about conditions there.
I did find out that Calhoun County, right next to my county, is like a third world country right now. No sewer, no running water, no electricity. They have a curfew in place, and they're urging all evacuees not to come home for at least the next few days.
So she's listening to that advice and not leaving Yoakum for a few days. While she's nervous about seeing the state of her house, she still considers herself lucky. She and her mother are safe.
Texas Governor Greg Abbott has activated the entire Texas National Guard, all 12,000 members, in response to Hurricane Harvey. It's a tropical storm now, but catastrophic flooding from Harvey continues to cripple Houston, and more rain is in the forecast. Officials say once Harvey has dissipated, drainage will continue to be a problem, and that flooding that's already devastated the region could get even worse. FEMA Administrator Brock Long spoke about this earlier today.
Helping Texas overcome this disaster is going to be far greater than FEMA coordinating the mission of the entire federal government. We need citizens to be involved. Texas, this is a landmark event. We have not seen an event like this. You could not draw this forecast up.
Well, let's check in now with NPR's Nathan Rott. He's part of NPR's team covering Harvey, and he's in Columbus, Texas, about 70 miles outside of Houston. And Nathan, tell me, what's going on there?
As you can hear, it's kind of raining, not as hard as it was just a little while ago. Winds are gusting. And there's a lot of action here in town as people are moving and trying to evacuate. Columbus is right on the banks of the Colorado River, which is beyond flood stage. We drove over the river earlier today on Interstate 10, and it's hard to tell where the banks start or end. The river is expected to crest today just north of here at about 54 feet. And for perspective, flood stage begins at 26. So we're looking at maybe a doubling of that level here later today. That's really problematic for people here in Columbus because a lot of the homes here are below that flood level stage. I talked to a guy in a residential neighborhood here earlier who said that about a third of homeowners are beneath that stage. Those people are under mandatory evacuation notices, and I think from what I understand, those evacuation notices keep expanding outwards.
Wow. I mean, those are astonishing numbers for river levels. I mean, we've been hearing, for example, that, you know, in response, 911 systems in the area are being overwhelmed or have been overwhelmed with calls for help since Harvey made landfall. I mean, Houston has rescued 2,000 people from floodwaters there. I mean, how are first responders focusing their efforts?
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly, I think, a huge issue in Houston. I mean, you're talking about a city of 6.6 million people experiencing an unprecedented amount of rainfall. I know that some of my colleagues have done some really good reporting on that in Houston. Out here, it's a little harder to tell. There's certainly a lot of police activity, a lot of emergency officials moving around. This is a really rural area. I mean, everywhere outside of Houston is really rural on these kind of two-lane back roads and everything. So, I mean, you have people that are spread over an incredibly huge amount of area. I know that police and emergency officials are focusing on elderly people, people that are maybe not physically fit to help evacuate or take care of themselves. That's certainly been the focus in Houston, and I'd imagine that's a focus here. One thing that's kind of interesting that we're seeing in Houston, we've seen here and talked to people about here, is it's not just emergency officials. I mean, it's Good Samaritans and citizens. We ran into a guy at a Walmart parking lot with a big boat in the back of his truck who's trying to go help some homeowners close to the banks of the Colorado River here and do what he can to try to help them out.
Right. I mean, so that echoes what we heard FEMA Administrator Brock Long say earlier, that citizens need to get involved. I mean, Nathan, tell me, it looks like where you are in Columbus, they could be facing some very serious flooding in the next coming days. I mean, what more have people been telling you about how they're going to try and cope when that river crests?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, I think in Houston, we've seen a lot of the flooding. I think we're going to see some of the flooding here happen a little later. I mean, we're starting to see it kind of happen right now as those rivers go up. And I mean, it's raining now. It's going to keep raining. The ground here is completely saturated. Driving on the interstate, you can just see it pooling on either side. I mean, so there's nowhere for this rain to go.
Yeah.
It's going to just flood more.
Well, that's NPR's Nathan Rott reporting from Columbus, Texas, about 70 miles outside of Houston. Nathan, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, in other news, a third round of Brexit talks opened in Brussels today. Great Britain voted, as we remember, to leave the European Union in June of last year, and Prime Minister Theresa May triggered the formal process to start Brexit last March. There are many thorny issues to work out, though, in these divorce proceedings, and so far there hasn't been much progress in the talks. Joining us from Brussels is BBC News Europe reporter Gavin Lee. Gavin, remind us what the big issues are as these talks resume.
Well, there are three, actually. There are three sticking points, because ultimately, the European Union, for Britain to leave, the language is that the chief negotiator, they call him Monsieur Brexit, Michel Barnier, who's negotiating on behalf of the other 27. So basically, the Brits go in, they meet one person, his team, he goes back and says, here's where we are. So they're up to round three. The three things are, basically, they call it the Brexit exit bill. How much does Britain have to pay when it leaves the EU for what's, you know, it owes, future projects, things like that? So far, there's an impasse on that because there's been a quote of around 60 billion euros, which, you know, the Foreign Secretary of the UK, Boris Johnson, had said they can go whistle for it. I mean, essentially, they're not going to get it. Now they want to agree on a methodology. Basically, how do you, you know, we agree that X plus Y equals Z, you pay Z. But the Brits at the moment are saying, no, we'll do our own methodology. We don't want to do that yet. So there's impasse one. Impasse two is what you do with the Irish border. So you have the Republic of Ireland, member of the EU, Northern Ireland, part of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, which is won't be a member of the EU. There's been a recent document, paper released by the British government to say that there'll be no hard border because there's something like 300 different border checkpoints, areas of the physical border of the island of Ireland to Northern Ireland. Now the Brits are saying there won't be a physical border. We'll have some kind of scheme whereby you can trust who's coming in and out. Hmm. You've got the EU side saying, well, hang on a minute, is that a magic formula? How's that going to stop smuggling and trade and things like that? And the final issue is the idea of citizens. There are 3 million EU citizens in the UK. There's 1 million Brits in Europe. Who oversees their future? The Europeans want it to be the European Court of Justice. Many of the British government say, well, hang on a minute, that gives too much power back to Europe. We want a new body to be set up. And in a nutshell, it's those three things that are stopping any further progress.
So it's no surprise then that we hear your BBC colleague Kevin Connolly says the overall mood around the talks is mutual exasperation.
Yeah, I mean, look, this is round three, and there's always a bit of sort of trash-talking of each other to some degree. So we've had David Davis, who's the Britain's chief negotiator, coming in as the Brexit minister, they call him, saying that they want the EU to be more sort of imaginative, more free with it. It's too restrictive, and therefore in the talks will be better. You have the EU's chief negotiator saying the issue of Ireland, well, it's just fantasy land. It won't happen. I mean, it's hardly sort of Mayweather-McGregor in terms of its vicious trash talking, but this is both sides trying to eke something out of the other. And what we have now is 4 days where the big ugly building, I've got to say, the European Commission building in front of me, so 7 stories high, 30,000 people sit in there. They call them the Sherpas. There'll be about 200 civil servants on both sides that sit down on the 13th floor for 4 days now to try to work out the nuances of differences in opinion. And, you know, it's going to be for some. They call it, it's one for the technical specialists. They mean it could be a blumming boring week. But actually, by the end of it, if there's some progress, both sides want to be able to get to the next stage of this divorce settlement. My take on this, and I've followed it for the past 2.5 years, this will be a week that gets us to September, where they have the next round. In September, everybody talks about that as being the key round. So maybe this is the hors d'oeuvre.
Now, David Miliband, who used to be a major figure in the opposition Labour Party in the UK, says there should be a second referendum on Brexit because this is just such a mess at this point.
Yeah.
Is there
yeah.
any chance of that happening?
On paper right now, it doesn't appear so. I couldn't rule it out. I don't think anybody rules it out apart from Theresa May, the Prime Minister, frankly says that that moment is done. Article 50 has been triggered, which is the formal mechanism to leave the EU. It gives you a 2-year starter clock, so Britain has to be gone by March 2019. Now, it's never been used before, but technically it can be untriggered. So it is possible if there was another referendum, you could untrigger it, but the other 27 heads of state of the European Union would have to agree. But I'd say it's unlikely because of this. I listened to the language of people people like the French president, Emmanuel Macron, or the German chancellor, Angela Merkel. At one stage, there was a bit of an openness, particularly the Dutch prime minister, Mark Rutte, would say, I think there'll be a second referendum. I can't see Britain leaving the EU. But that language has really changed in the other leaders now. They all say, you know, we are waiting for it to happen. It's not a case of if anymore. So I think he is what David Miliband is one of a number of sort of hopeful, perhaps wishful thinkers in the UK. The way the rhythm of the talks are going at the moment, it doesn't seem to be an open door to suggest a second referendum.
That's the BBC's Gavin Lee in Brussels, where a third round of Brexit talks opened today. Gavin, thanks so much.
All the best. Speak to you soon.
Did you know they're calling Boise, Idaho, the new Portland, Oregon, as in a rapidly gentrifying hipster haven with a lot of out-of-state transplants? Let's ask Harrison Berry. He's a staff reporter with Boise Weekly. Hi, Harrison.
Hello.
And have you heard people say that, that Boise is the next Portland? And what do you think about it?
Well, yeah, I have heard that. I've also heard Boise is the next Seattle. Boise is the next Austin. I think that Boise has a bit of its own identity.
Well, how has it been changing in recent years? I mean, are you starting to already see signs of people moving in from elsewhere and making it more like some of those cities out in the Pacific Northwest?
Absolutely, yeah. In fact, there are some pretty robust advertising campaigns in some of those larger cities that are promoting Boise's lower cost of living. It's a very safe city. People really like to come here, especially from the tech sector. That is changing the look and feel of Boise. For a long time, Boise has been kind of flyover country, and that is changing in a big way. And I think that's what invites some of those comparisons.
What about the hipster scene in Boise? Because that is often a sign that a city is, you know, coming into a different identity.
Right. And that's the funny thing about youth culture is that it's always going to kind of be there. Yeah, there was a time when hipster was a very current term in Boise. We actually ended up banning it from use over at Boise Weekly.
Why did you ban the term hipster?
It was just one of those things that was becoming overused. It bordered on cliche. I feel like, you know, 5 or 10 years ago, that term hipster really denoted something specific. And in Boise, that something specific started to change. It stopped being as relevant a term as maybe it felt when the skinny jeans and stocking caps were more prevalent here.
So what do you use now to describe the new Boise residents?
Oh, heavens. By and large, new Boise residents come from a professional class. They're coming here with a little bit of work experience. It's a little bit more buttoned up than you know, what we might describe as a hipster.
Are the prices of housing going up?
They are, definitely. And that's creating a real pinch for people who live and work near downtown. You know, the people who sling your coffee are kind of being pushed to the outskirts while, you know, some of those rentals and for sale homes are being scooped up by people with more disposable income. It is, in fact, a real problem.
The city of Boise and Idaho in general is overwhelmingly white. Is that starting to change?
That really is. Boise is, on top of being white, Boise is also one of the largest per capita destinations for refugees and new Americans. We're beginning to see, obviously, a lot more people of color on here in Boise, but, you know, other kinds of diversity as well. That's definitely picking up. The idea that Boise is a white city is something that's going to change in the near future, I think.
Well, as things do change in Boise, what do you hope stays the same?
Boise is it's kind of locked in this struggle between wanting to be a big city and a small town. It's sort of like Cheers. Everybody knows your name. And that's something that I hope sticks around. You know, in some of those bigger cities, it's a little bit easier to be anonymous, and that can be comforting sometimes. But in Boise, you really start to feel welcome almost on the first day that you're here for newcomers. And if you've been here for a long time, that's a feeling of inclusivity that's very difficult to leave behind.
Now, Portland has become famous for its food. What are we going to start to eat now that Boise is coming into this new identity?
Oh, so Boise has for a long time had a very strong
Basque cultural undercurrent. Many of some of the first settlers here came from the Basque country. And in the Basque country itself, some of the foods of choice, it gravitates towards seafood. And in Boise, the Basques gravitated toward lamb. And so, you know, we have these amazing spicy lamb grinders. I can't speak highly enough of them. You won't find them anywhere else. But of course, there's the paella. That is probably some of the best you'll find anywhere. Hmm. In addition, we've had a lot – I mentioned sort of the new Americans. A lot of them are bringing their own culinary traditions to bear on Boise. And I think over time we're going to start to see a lot more, you know, not just representation of those traditions but also some experimentation.
Now, with all these newcomers, one of the things they're going to have to learn is that the proper pronunciation of – your city is Boise, right? Not Boise.
That's correct. Boise is the shibboleth. Boise is what people coming in from out of town say.
So you can always tell when they're tourists.
Absolutely.
Right. It's, and how long did it take? How long have you been in Boise?
I have been in Boise for almost 19 years now. I moved here from Portland on my 13th birthday in 1998.
You did. You moved from Portland.
I did.
So you were way ahead of the curve.
I was way ahead of the curve, and I learned early on that when you come to Boise, you bring along the chapstick. It's a different beast.
That is Harrison Berry, who's a staff reporter with Boise Weekly. Harrison, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
And Boise residents, Portland residents, let us know your thoughts on this at hereandnow.org. We're a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Here and Now.